afternoon and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy. Our topic today is the LEO Network, operated through the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, or ANTHC. It works out of the Center for Climate, the Department of Community, Environment, and Health. So what is the LEO Network? LEO stands for Local Environmental Observations. The network is housed on a website that allows for users to share photographs and post questions or details of unusual sightings. It even locates those sightings or events on a map. Participants include on-the-ground observers who share knowledge about unusual animal, environment, and weather events. Members of the network can connect with others, share their observations, raise awareness, and find answers about significant environmental events. They can also engage with topic experts in different organizations and become part of a broader observer community. The network stretches across Alaska in both urban and rural areas, but it also reaches to the lower 48 and even internationally to Canada, Iceland, Siberia, and other areas. Over time, it tells a story about climate change and impacts on health. Today we have, from the LEO Network, Mike Brubaker, Director of the Department of Community, Environment, and Health at ANTHC. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you, Kathleen.
So happy to have you today.
It's nice to be here.
Yeah. And I know Mike reached out across this vast network and invited a few participants to join us during the show. So we expect to hear from a few of them during the hour. We've got callers perhaps from Unalakleet, near Nome, and Fairbanks. But before we start our discussion, let me alert you to a little bit of information on our website. You can check out alaskapublic.org and find Hometown Alaska under the radio listings. We have links to the LEO Network and even a link to a little short video of about a minute in length that explains how the network works and how you could participate and some of the news stories of the LEO Network. So you are invited, if you've been an observer and you want to talk to us about the network, or you want to find out how you might be an observer, or whether you could be an urban observer or a rural observer, give us a call, because we've got a great person in the studio today to tell us about the LEO Network, and we'll hear stories of the impact of the network today. So we really would love to hear from you. You can give us a call in Anchorage at 550-8433. Statewide, it's 1-888-353-5752. And we also welcome your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. All right. Let's get started, Mike. I thought at first we would just talk about what is the LEO Network. I know I said it's local environmental observers or observations, but that doesn't really paint a picture. So help us.
Sure. So the network is composed of people all around Alaska. It's really, when we say network, it's a network of people, but it lives on a website. So if you go and you can search for it and it'll pop up and you'll see a map. And what's on that map are observations that people have shared from around the state, mostly about unusual environmental events. So, I mean, the idea here is that people in Alaska live close to the land. I guess that's something that, you know, defines many Alaskans, is we're outside, we're hunting, we're traveling, visiting family across the state. Sometimes we do it at the same time each year, and we're able to see again and again some similar types of climate and seasonal and environmental conditions, and that people are really good at noticing subtle change. And sometimes those subtle changes are significant. And so we really rely on the members of the network. So when you see something that, based on your knowledge, you feel is significant, unusual, and something you'd like to share, that's what LEO Network was developed for. It's an easy way to take a photo, to share a story. And sometimes we're able to take those and pass them on to people who really are topical experts. So we're trying to understand how Alaska is changing. There's a lot of change happening in all kinds of different ways. And this was a tool that was developed by the Tribal Health System to help us do that.
It kind of reminds me of a giant cyber bulletin board, in a way,
yeah,
that you can dial into and check in. Well, we are actually getting a couple calls, so let's go ahead and take a caller. Oh, okay. That's one of our participants. So we'll come to him in a few minutes. Let's see. Let's talk about how old the network is and how it got started.
I think, you know, the origins go back to really about 2009. But really, you know, what informed the development of LEO started even before that. And at that point, we started to see some of the first articles published about the connections between climate change and health impacts.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those was in about 2005, there was an outbreak of enteritis, gastroenteritis.
Stomach upset.
Yeah. And it was a marine variety that's commonly associated with consumption of oysters. And it happened on a cruise ship here in Alaska. And the person who's currently our state epidemiologist, Dr. Joe McLaughlin, was one of the authors of this paper. And they were able to show that warm water temperatures, uncommon to Alaska, really up, you know, near 60 degrees, had been the tipping point which had allowed for this Vibrio parahemolyticus, it's called, this bloom or this, you know, infection to occur in the oysters. And that's resulted in, like, you know, 20% or 15 to 20% of the passengers on the ship getting sick.
Ooh.
So that was emergence of something new that happened when the water temperature warmed up 1,000 kilometers further north than it had ever been documented before. And then a year after that, there was another paper published. It was the year, it was 2006, and it was the first time that there had been a death in Alaska from a anaphylactic shock from an insect sting.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Jeffrey DeMaine published a paper saying, you know, when the winters are warm, we see in the year after that a lot more wasps. And so these years when you have crazy amounts of wasps may be related to changes in winter temperatures.
Hmm.
So we were starting to get clues that warming was resulting in new types of disease and new types of injury. And so the tribal health system began to get calls from leadership around the state and community members saying, you know, it's January, we don't have any snow, or we're getting really high rates of erosion, or
mm-hmm.
our lake dried up. These things were happening, these events. And so we thought, you know, we really need a way to begin to start documenting what these events are, because the events can be really significant. And if we understand that, then maybe we can better understand to plan and how to adapt to it.
Okay. Now, first of all, people can find the LEO Network by just Googling LEO Network, right? I mean, that's how I found it. It just pops up. So, but you do have to be a member. Tell me about the membership aspect of it.
Sure. Well, it's free. Anyone can join. And so, and we ask this sort of really general question, which is based on your knowledge, based on your experience, is there something unusual happening in the environment? It could be the weather, it could be changes to the landscape, a new type of insect, types of invasive plants.
Mm-hmm.
And so people usually very quickly will go ahead and share that in a post, and I'll tell you how that happens.
Okay.
The thing that we found, we started going around Alaska and talking to different communities where they were, documenting these early symptoms of climate change or advanced symptoms of environmental change that were occurring. And what we realized was that it was going to require a lot of people with a lot of different expertise to help these communities understand what's happening. And, you know, from all different areas of, science and traditional knowledge and health community and engineering and so forth. And so we started to look for ways to do that. And that's what.
Yeah, and one of the things I know we're going to hear from Rick Tolman here. He's on the line, but when in a few minutes
Great.
We'll bring him on. The thing that struck me when I learned about who's in the network is there's lots of people that represent expertise from other agencies that are a part of this network. So it pulls people from all walks of life, all scientists, you know, rural residents, academics. It just pulls, and so you're like almost a giant facilitator to pinpoint, sort of to drive the knowledge where it's needed. You know, if someone raises an issue, an observation. So who all's involved?
Well, that's right, Kathleen. And, you know, people see these things. And there's actually lots of resources out there. You know, people who have expertise about sea ice or invasive weeds or insects or fish disease and all these different, and people, you know, but finding these people sometimes is hard. And I think that's where our specialty is making that introduction for the first time and hopefully developing someone who would otherwise never meet someone else, mm-hmm. From a community in Alaska, meeting someone perhaps in an agency. Then have something to talk about, something to work on, and we call those consults. Mm-hmm. So the application actually works is when I see something that I think I want to share, I fill out a little text box saying, you know, what day it is, what location. I take a photo. It asks the question, you know, what's significant about this? Usually type in a few sentences describing the event. And then you send it. It comes into ANTHC. We have people on our team who are facilitating technical consults. And what we try to do is then to link them with someone at a organization that has topical expertise and capacity to work on these things. And that can be at the university. It can be for a you know, nonprofit organization, it can be a government agency. And that's the other part of the network is it's all of these people who are contributing their time to help people in communities understand mm-hmm. what these changes are.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I think about is this is a huge state. Even if you're an expert on, a scientific expert on one sort of land mammals or birds or something like that, you can't possibly be eyes on the ground all over this giant state. And yet, with a network like this, you can get people who also are really familiar with their surroundings and have lived there for a long time and notice when things are different. And that can elevate that discussion immediately and link, you know, the rural expert with the scientific expert.
Yep.
Yeah.
And you could be a 14-year-old youth who's made a great observation because you have good observational skills. And you take a photo and you send it in, and we connect you with someone, a National Weather Service or NOAA or the Cooperative Extension Service or USGS or whoever it might be. Mm-hmm. And they're your co-author, mm-hmm. and they add their knowledge. So we're pooling knowledge together. And then we have some really talented people in our office here in Anchorage who are, we have Moses Cherepanoff, who is a geographer, and we have Mike Brook, who is a software engineer, and we have Erica Mitchell, who works on, looking at the educational aspects of LEO and outreach. So we have these people kind of look at the observation, and they say, maybe some temperature data. Maybe we can pull some temperature data and provide some context. Or maybe there's a satellite image that might show, you know, where this algal bloom is occurring. And so we try to, connect some of the dots mm-hmm. And enhance the story by putting in information that might be useful to provide context.
So you get published. A thread going. So you get right. The original observation, and then you might get a scientist who, or an academic or someone with specific knowledge that might then add some information. Now, can the original observer come back and continue the conversation?
They can, and what we see happen quite often is the conversation takes off in a new direction. So we like to see, because there's a divide between what we're doing, we call it observing, and then there's sort of more applied scientific approach, which we usually refer to as monitoring. So when you get to the point where you start to collect water temperature or looking at weather measurements or things like that, that's really, there are very robust built systems to do that. And that's kind of a deeper dive into the topic.
Okay.
What we're doing is sort of, these are first signals.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah.
Canary in the mine sort of thing.
Right.
Right.
And if you live in a remote community in Alaska, or you live in your, you know, even in your neighborhood, something happens and you're not sure whether you're the only one. So having a way that you can elevate this event and sort of see whether it resonates in other places can all of a sudden help us to understand something that's not very localized. It's actually something much bigger. And when it's much bigger, sometimes it requires and can garner resources to deal with it more effectively. Mm-hmm. So that's part of what we're trying to build as well, mm-hmm. is ways to do that.
Yeah. If people are just dialing in and sort of hearing our show, we're talking today about the LEO Network, and we have Mike Brubaker of the LEO Network with us today. And LEO stands for Local Environmental Observations?
Observer. It's about the person.
Yeah. About the person, yeah. Okay. And it's all across Alaska, and it's reached out into, the lower 48, other Arctic communities, Canada. I saw some posts from Iceland. I think I saw some from Siberia. So it's really boundaryless. I mean, it's just really on the internet, and people can find it and weigh in and contribute. We talked a little bit about the fact that many agencies are involved sort of as because they have expertise, and the LEO Network can pull them in. And we actually have one on the phone right now. So I'd like to welcome Rick Toman. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Kathleen.
How are you?
Just great.
Thanks so much for being available today. You are up in Fairbanks, I think, right?
I am, yes.
And what kind of weather are you having up there today?
Well, it's been a mild day. We had some clouds overnight, some sun this morning. Now clouds moving back in. Starting to look like dynamic autumn weather.
Oh, yeah. We're having a little bit of that down here in Anchorage, too. So I understand you're with the National Weather Service.
Yeah, I work as the Climate Science and Services Manager for Weather Service in Alaska.
So, Mike and I are here. I'm going to launch you. I just want you to tell us, what can you tell us about the climate and change, kind of the big picture? I thought that was too big a question, and I said to Mike, I don't know how to answer that. And he said, no, that's actually, what you do, Rick. So tell us a little bit about what you see, what observations you're making about weather here. And I think we were actually talking about the blob, actually, and understanding the blob's impact on Alaska weather. So just fill us in a little bit.
Well, I'd be happy to do that, Kathleen. Let me start out. Of course, as you were just mentioning, Alaska is a big place. And environmental changes, for instance, in southern southeast are quite different than, say, environmental changes on the North Slope. And the impacts on communities and people are equally varied. With that in mind, stepping back, of course, it's no surprise to any Alaskan over the last several decades, temperatures have warmed considerably. Sea ice has decreased very dramatically during the late summer and autumn season. Fire seasons are frequently stronger. It's warming up sooner in the spring. Again, these are multi-decadal averages. There's lots of year-to-year variability. That's not going to change. But overall, a general warming, more pronounced in some seasons than others, more pronounced in some places than others. But overall, that's the big picture for Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me a little bit more specifically about the blob. I know Mike was referencing a paper you're working on about kind of what to expect next for Alaska from that. And that, tell us what the blob is. I know it's warm water out in the ocean, and I know it was around the Aleutians, but what's the latest on the blob, and what can we expect in terms of weather?
Yeah, so the blob was kind of a fun name that I don't think was supposed to stick, but it did. originally an area of much above sea surface temperatures in the Northeast Pacific, kind of south of the Gulf of Alaska, during the winter of 2013-14. And that very warm water persisted for the better part of 3 years. Eventually, we saw those very warm sea surface temperatures spread into the Bering Sea, particularly during 2014-2016 were exceptional. In the Gulf of Alaska, sea surface temperatures are closer to normal now, continue to be above normal in the Bering Sea and the Chukchi Sea. The Bering, not quite as much as they were last year. We're working on a publication that kind of documents what happened during 2016 with the very warm sea surface temperatures. And importantly, and this is where the LEO network comes into play here, not just what happened with the physical science, but what were the impacts of those warm sea surface temperatures on people and on the resources that Alaskans are dependent on. So whether it's harmful algal blooms, whether it's the lack of sea ice or very short ice seasons in western Alaska, these are the kind of things that we're interested in looking at. How did these warm sea surface temperatures, not just how, why did they occur, and can we attribute that to larger scale forcing, but what are the impacts on Alaskans?
Mm-hmm. So I think, Mike, you were telling me that while you were working on this paper, you looked at LEO network observations and observers' comments to sort of get a timeline. So could you tell us how you used LEO for this?
Well, what we did is you have a certain time frame and you have a certain geographic range. And so we identified that, and then we just started to pull in observations that we felt could potentially have been related. And what happened over that time period is it was just a proliferation of observations were happening all around the state. And some of them were kind of one-offs. We'd see something that didn't really seem to resonate, and then other ones seemed to have a real long resonance to them. And examples are observations about bird die-offs, observations about sea mammal die-offs or sea mammal illness, harmful algal blooms, unusual weather conditions that were happening.
Storm surges, things like that? Or?
Not so much the storm surges, more like the unseasonable rain conditions and variability. And in the weather, and we looked at things, even things like we have a lot of observations about berry harvest, and we were going from years where people were having unusual abundance to nothing, and sort of that lack of reliable harvest, and then things like Rick was mentioning with sea ice change, that was a huge one, and that affects people's ability to use the ice as a platform and harvest from it. And people were adapting and doing it in different ways. And what we did is when we saw the strong signals reoccurring from many locations, observation again, again, and again, and again, those are the ones we really highlighted in the paper.
Mm-hmm. And Rick, from your perspective, tell me how you use these LEO observations and, the sort of on-the-ground things that are bubbling up. How do you use them?
In the Weather Service, the LEO network really provides us really a unique window on what's really important to people on the ground. Many of the LEO observations are things that we have no other way to get that information.
Mm-hmm.
And it really provides a unique window that within the Weather Service, as we work to provide impact-based decision support so that we're focused on the things in the environment that really matter to people on the ground. LEO Network is invaluable for that.
Now, Rick, how did you get into it? Were you invited into it because you have expertise in climate and weather, or did you stumble on it and say, wow, this is going to be useful for me? How did you get connected?
Mike, you might have to help me out here. as part of my job, I do a monthly a climate webinar through ACAP, and in there we recap recent conditions. And I don't know, Mike, was that how you first picked up on me?
I think that's right. I think we heard you talking, presenting, and we said we have a bunch of stuff we'd like to send to Rick, and then we sent an email and said, hey, look at this observation. What do you think about? Would you be willing to provide us with a consult? And then Rick came back with this, really insightful, in-depth analysis. And that's how a lot of these discussions happen.
That's great. So, I mean, it's a little bit of a different way to... Observation is always a big part of science, right? But But it's anecdotal, and that's different from the way science actually normally works. So could we talk a little bit about that just for folks who aren't scientists and don't know what the process normally is and how do observations like this fit in?
Yeah, it's a really important theme, you know, in the network is, you know, sort of recognizing the value of the local anecdotal observational information. And I think maybe I can give an example here, you know, because I think all of these different types, you know, both the measured science, the analytical science, with the local and traditional knowledge, they all complement each other mm-hmm. really well. And in fact, when you can find ways to apply them together, it really can create a much better, you know, overview and understanding of what's going on. You know, how that actually happens is something that a lot of people are trying to understand and improve on.
Mm-hmm.
But just by way of example, this might be another blob-related scenario, but there was a huge run of chum salmon that went up the Noatak, it was the Kobuk River. And you might remember in the news that, you know, the fishermen were just setting up like crazy in Kotzebue and really having an amazing season and having trouble processing fish and so forth. So all these fish, you know, at levels people really hadn't seen before started to go up the Kobuk to spawn. And that was in the backdrop of a winter before where there wasn't any much snow, and a summer where there wasn't a lot of rain, and the river was low, and the water was warm. And so an observation was posted, I think it was from Ambler or Kobuk, by the environmental coordinator at the tribe there, and she said, hey, we're getting lots and lots of fish that are dying before they spawn. And we also have this algae in the water that's unusual, and the water is really warm, and people don't even want to step in it. And we're wondering, is the salmon safe, you know, even to feed to our dogs? So, and what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
So there you have a problem statement in the scientific terminology.
Got it.
And you've got a background, a really rich description, and you've got, you know, sort of a technical, topical expert there.
Mm-hmm.
So we get that a lot where, you know, the whole question and maybe even a hypothesis and is set up. And then what happens next is samples are collected. They're sent off to, in that case, they went to the fish pathology lab at ADF&G. And Fish and Game can look at it in the lab and they can say, you know, these fish actually had a lot of different algae in their gills. We're not quite sure what they died from. It may have been lack of oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, is it safe or not? They can answer those kinds of questions. So now we have what happened. We have, you know, maybe a little bit of why did it happen or, you know, or what was the cause. But getting to the next question is really more of a monitoring research partnership that has to happen with people locally and maybe from the university or from mm-hmm. agencies. And that is, why is it happening here?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it happening now? And is there anything we should know or do differently in the future to make sure that, you know, we have healthy fish and we have healthy people?
Mm-hmm.
So that requires a lot of different people with a lot of different knowledge. And so a lot of times the observations come in and they say, I'm telling you here, this hasn't happened before. And I talk to my neighbors and my relatives and my grandparents, and they all haven't seen it either. So we have a pretty good measure of time with people who are very familiar with the environment. And we trust and we recognize and we respect those kinds of knowledge sharing.
Mm-hmm. You know, Rick, you're still with us. I was wondering whether you had an example of maybe the tale that spun out from an observation. I don't know if you have one. You know, you may be doing more things related to blob and big picture stuff, but do you have a story about something that began with a kernel of an observation that you were able to work with?
Sure. I think 2 or maybe 3 years ago, I think it was from Chivac, but somewhere in western Alaska, there was multiple posts of funnel clouds being observed. and they were posted to the LEO network. And this was extremely useful. There's been over the years multiple funnel cloud reports in Alaska. With the proliferation of cell phones these days, we're getting more and more of them. And this actually helped feed into some research that was done here at the university on the topic of funnel clouds in Alaska. And, of course, funnel clouds in Alaska are really kind of only distant cousins to what makes the news, the big tornadoes in the Midwest.
Oh, I was just wondering, are we going to start getting tornadoes here?
No. They're just very, very distant cousins.
Okay.
Those observations from the LEO network, helped to bring that, bring more attention to that. Even though we're not going to become Oklahoma anytime in the near future.
Let's
hope.
It
is important to understand that, to help people to understand what they're seeing now, and with the advent of modern technology, able to document.
Right. Well, Rick, is there anything we haven't asked you that you're dying to tell us? Because I'm going to take a little break here, and we have another caller from the LEO Network. We have John Henry on from Unalakleet, but we have to take a tiny break before we bring John on. So one last thing, is there one message you've got as a scientist, as a weather climate scientist, that you want to put out there about the LEO Network?
You bet. I'm going to put out my. I do this every time. Mike hears me say this frequently. The LEO Network is a fantastic way for folks in Alaska to make available the things that they're seeing. Your observations that you put into that LEO Network are getting looked at. They are being analyzed. We're working to understand it. So I will put out my regular plea. Please send in more observations to the LEO Network.
Oh, that's great, Rick. All right. And we'll remind folks how to do that. If they're not a member and don't know where it is, we'll spend a little time in the second half letting people know how to do that. So thanks so much, Rick Toman from the National Weather Service in Fairbanks. We really appreciate your calling in.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.
And as I said, we're going to take a tiny break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Hometown Alaska, and I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. And if you're just joining us, our topic today is the LEO Network. That stands for Local Environment Observers, so that's the LEO. And the network is kind of a cyber bulletin board where people can post unusual sightings for things they see in nature, animal behavior, things that are different. They can post them to this network. It isn't any harder than really Facebook. I mean, it's very similar to social media, but it's driving at creating a picture of climate change or changes in the environment and how those might ultimately be affecting health. So, yes, Mike, go ahead.
Well, it's funny that you bring up Facebook because that was one of our, motivators for developing the network.
Mm-hmm.
Was we were at a meeting with about 100 different environmental managers from around the state, and they're all showing us pictures on Facebook that they had.
Uh-huh.
And Facebook is great for telling you what's happening right now, but it's not really designed for telling you for archiving or putting things on a map.
Uh-huh.
And so we realized that something else was needed that would have some communication functions, but also be a good mapping tool. And So now when those people, there's a profile just like in Facebook, and all of your stuff is in there when you post an observation on LEO, and your map, your own personal map of the observations
that you've been documenting. Yeah. So we do have John Henry with us on the phone right now from Unalakleet. Welcome, John. Hi, John.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Really delighted to have you call. Really appreciate your time. I know that you are an environmental manager in Unalakleet with the tribe there. How did you get involved with LEO?
That's an excellent question, Catherine. My predecessor, Victoria Kintugan, was my supervisor then. I got first hired in 2014. And some of the things that came to my attention was some of the efforts that she put towards, one of which was the LEO network. And she made mention of it briefly in passing. And it got stuck in my ear. And then when I went to the ATCM event, which is the Alaska Tribal Conference on Environmental Management in Anchorage, I got to see more and more. I was more and more exposed to a LEO network, and it really spurred my interest, mainly because of the ability to, as was mentioned by Mike Brubaker, as a way to archive or document changes that are occurring not only locally but regionally and statewide as well. So it really had an interest, and I liked the way the direction was going, and it has come a long way since it got involved.
So can you give me some examples of how, well, first of all, I understand you have posted some observations, but how does Unalakleet use this information? Do you find that you are able to use the information in real practical and pragmatic ways in Unalakleet?
Kathleen, I mean, that is a very good question in terms of our program. One of the things that each tribe needs to have in their program is what they call an ETEP, and that's the EPA Tribal Environmental Plan. It's basically four components, but the main thing, one of the components is the environmental priorities, and that is with the tribe, for that village, they get to kind of determine which direction they would like the program to go to. And for me, our tribe, in developing the ETEP, which is also required for creature funding post fiscal year 2018, is that they wanted to focus on climate change. And this online digital media is a perfect fit for it. So since I got in, and from now we've had about 20 observations that are posted just in Unalakleet alone.
20, did you say, John?
Our first observation was submitted on October 23rd of 2013, and since then we've had 20 posts. And of those posts, you can see a thematic similarity between the submittals, and it really basically focus on change. And ones I've seen are tied to mainly weather changes. And this, to me, is a perfect way of being a starting discussion if, say, Unalakleet wants to, which is included on ETEP, to work on what one of the components is the climate change adaptation planning document. So this would be a nice segue that will lead into a discussion. These are the archived documents that were submitted by the EPA environmental staff. And that could be a starting discussion with communities, could be a starting discussion with those that would be involved. So mm-hmm. It is a great way, a great system, not only documenting, but really seeing what's going on, not only locally, but regionally and statewide as well.
Yeah. John, could you just describe, say, an observation that you made so we can kind of get a picture in our head of the change that you were noticing? It could be a recent one or an early one. I'm just trying to get a feel for what kind of changes you were documenting.
I've got several. These were kind of on an extreme end. This one was entitled Fast Sea Ice Movement and was submitted on May 21st of 2017, which was then forwarded to the Sea Ice Project that's hosted by UAF International Arctic Research Center. But the observations are as is. It was on a Sunday, May 21st, at about 7:30. I stated that I glanced out the window of this building and I saw the ice flow along the shoreline of Alaska, Uncleet. And I could see that there are various sizes, chunks and sizes, and they're broken into space at different various lengths along my horizontal line of sight. And then shortly thereafter, at about 8:30, I went and looked out the window, the same window, and there was no ice.
Wow.
So then I look along the coastline, and I saw a whole bunch of piles of white. What I could see at the distance would be the ice. And not only this, but this was brought to my attention beforehand, and the longstanding elder made mention of how he noticed a change in ice flow direction and speed over the past few years. And before, he said he could predict where the ice would be and plan accordingly, but now he says it's harder to predict where it will be due to the fast changes that are occurring. And that statement that I made mention just goes in line with his statement.
Hmm.
So another similar one that I noted was entitled Fast Moving Hail Storm. And that was made on May 23rd of 2017. And that one was then forwarded to the National Weather Service for monitoring extreme weather events. But basically, at about 4:02 p.m., I observed hail coming down that lasted for about a minute. And as quickly as it came down, it abated. It stopped. I then proceeded to take photographs of the cloud formation about a minute after the event, and then two more within about 5 minutes, followed lastly by a picture about 4 or 3 minutes after the event, post-event. And I noticed a very fast change in how the characteristics of the cloud formation was. It started from dark clouds at about time zero, about 5 minutes thereafter. And then just within the 5 minutes, I could see changes in the cloud volume and the coloration from a dark gray to a lighter shade. And then at the end of it, it was the vast change in just the formation of the clouds. And that just, to me, I was seeing something similar, but on a faster scale in Columbus, Ohio. The weather changes real quickly. It was on a faster scale. I mean, but to me, these changes here in Alaska are occurring, but on a smaller scale. But they're occurring nonetheless. And it's the weather pattern, the frequency of the event, of the weather patterns are changing real quickly. But the duration of it, I'm seeing, is becoming shorter. You know,
What I like about hearing you talk about it, we can really see what you noticed, you know, like the dark clouds and then the light clouds, or the speed, or the size of the chunks of ice that were flowing by the shoreline, and then no ice. And also hearing that elders in your community were noting the same thing and noting the difference. So it kind of paints a picture of how to observe, actually. What are the important details to include? So that is really interesting. One last question for you, John. Has Unalakleet done anything differently based on being in the LEO network, or I guess I'm just trying to think in terms of planning or community safety and health. Have you taken the information from the LEO network, or maybe feedback from scientists, and actually done something in Unalakleet that, you know, responds to climate change in terms of moving buildings, or I don't know. I'm just trying to think of how it affects the community.
Well, that is a very good question, Kathleen. There's a program by NOAA, the Weather Ready Nation Ambassadorship Program, and WRN, but basically they're kind of the mediator between the National Weather Service and NOAA and the local communities. But this would fit perfectly within that program, and this, the observations that I'm seeing that do have a trend that are being repetitive year to year, seem to be repetitive. that's something that we actually plan for, like the ice flow changing rapidly, or specifically, I didn't really talk about, but the fall storms. I mean, that's another high ticket item for us here.
Mm-hmm.
But for planning purposes, it would, in the future, with more and more of these being documented and a trend being seen, that could be accounted for in a number of different organizations, another different areas of interest, whether it be putting into a document like the climate change adaptation plan document,
mm-hmm.
or whether it be working with NOAA on our weather ready Mason ambassador program. But to me, it's being able to document the event, and there's any trends, and like you mentioned, in the future they could be used, especially for, in our case, for those areas. So I do see a use for these documented events, and I could see how it could be implemented in different
mm-hmm.
whether it be fulfilling a document or whether it be working with agencies like NOAA.
Mm-hmm. And, you mentioned the fall storms. I guess we'd be coming into that potential season. Have you had any yet this year?
Nothing noticeable, but last year we did. And Edward Plume, another employee, National Weather Service, was kind enough to provide us a flood inundation map, which is basically a predictive estimate of
how deep the water might get if it surges
in. Based on a storm surge height, that tool allows it the projected flood height, basically,
mm-hmm.
on the map. So UniCleat was lucky enough to get a digital elevation model map done recently, and it was just a mapping that was done for UniCleat, which is amazing in itself, which is a nice tool that could be tied into other programs. And
right, deciding where to put buildings, all kinds of things, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so that information that he provided, I shared with the local law enforcement, and has made them aware that these are areas that might be impacted. And
mm-hmm.
what I tried to do in the past was to try and to get before and after
storm
information, yeah. Whether it be looking at the tide line and getting the waypoints for walking the tide line, which I mean, we did that 1 year after the storm. There's a tide line, which is basically a remnant of the storm that the debris lands on along the beach.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a cell phone and did some waypoints ever so many feet and sent that in to DGGS, and they were able to overlay that and make any corrections, and you get kind of map that or tie that into an existing
It's a state division of geological services. Yeah,
state division of geological services. So yeah, those are really good examples of how you can use the information and be better prepared. So Mike, anything you want to ask John, since we've got him on the phone here, and then we'll say goodbye, John, and say thank you for calling in. But anything else, Mike?
I just enjoyed hearing you describe the collection of observations and how you're using them, John. So thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much. I don't get many callers from UniCleat, so I'm really thrilled to have someone from UniCleat on the phone. So thanks a lot, John. Appreciate it.
There's one thing I want to add before I go.
Sure.
So this is a continuing partnership with National Weather Service, NOAA, with the Weather Ready Mason Ambassador Program. But one of the things I wanted you to say was that another way to actually tie into not only the predictions, but use it as a way to provide information so they can make adjustments to their predictive models. And that could be either walking in a tide line or taking pictures of the height of the water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, try and correlate the what their models are, and they can make adjustments. So that's built into our ETAP, and that's something that we want to do is our continuing partnership to make it a mutual benefit.
Yeah, I can see the benefit of that. As opposed to being reactive to things, you can sort of predict a little bit and project what the impact of, say, some of these fall storms might be, and then build accordingly or plan accordingly. So the kind of the resilience that gives you is really kind of inspiring. So anyway, yeah. John, thank you.
Yeah.
Really
yeah,
appreciate you.
I'm sorry I'm excited, but yeah, we got an aerial drone, and one of the things that we're planning to do is just to continue our work with National Weather Service and being able to document the different case events at the storm height.
Yeah.
But, I mean, yeah, so I'm excited about the aerial drone. I'm excited about the program. But thank you for having me, Captain McCoy, and I hope you have a great afternoon.
Oh, thank you. It's our pleasure. Thanks a lot, John. Take
care.
See you,
John.
So there were some things that I wanted to make sure we covered. First, let me just remind folks, we're talking about the LEO network, which is Local Environmental Observers. It's a network that spreads across the state. And as you can hear from John Henry and Unalakleet, people all over the state post things they notice. And that can be directed by the LEO network, workers at the LEO network, toward people working on that kind of science, whether it's the National Weather Service or, you know, Alaska Department of Fish and Game or U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, maybe, or
sure.
NOAA, any number of people. And so you get this almost very fast connection between the observers and people who maybe can have more questions or have context or weigh what this observation might mean. So I'm going to throw out our numbers one more time. 550-8433 in Anchorage, or 1-888-353-5752. And some of the things, Mike, you look like you have something on your mind, so just jump in and say, what is it?
Oh, no, I think you're right. I mean, there's these little teams developing, you know, based on events that are happening.
Yeah.
And it pulls in people from other places seeing similar things. And,
right.
And so it's, you know, in some cases there's really good monitoring systems in place, and sometimes they're just sort of starting up from scratch. But I found it interesting, John, talking about the way they're using handheld technology to try to get a better sense of the impacts from large storms.
Right. And so by that you mean just taking pictures with their phone?
It's the miracle of, you know, photo combined with GPS.
It's pretty amazing.
That you can walk around with.
And I was excited to hear him talk about the drones. I mean, I hadn't thought about that, but that might let him cover far more territory than, or there may be parts of the coast he can't walk, and yet visually he can capture information and share it.
Sure.
It's another, he seemed pretty excited about the drone.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, he mentioned a observation by one of his colleagues, Victoria Katongan, and I went ahead and pulled that up, and I think it's such an excellent example of the way an observation is written, and it has sort of a story behind it, too. So if I could, Kathleen.
Please do.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this was on October 7th, 2012, and the title was Worms and Grouse and Ptarmigan. And she writes that, it says, on Saturday the 6th and Sunday the 7th, I went grouse hunting up along the road to the White Owl site. On Saturday, I shot 6 spruce grouse and 2 ptarmigan. When I was cleaning the first grouse, I ripped open the breast, and there were worms squiggling on the top of the breast meat. 3 of the 6 grouse had these long, skinny, white worms on the meat. On Sunday the 7th, all 4 of the grouse had worms on or in the meat. 2 had worms coming out of the meat instead of just coming on coiled on top of the meat. So, I mean, this is really, you know, food safety, you know, this kind of question. She says, I love hunting and eating grouse. It's a food source of the community. I'm concerned about the health of the birds and the safety of the meat for the food. So she posted that with photos, and we were able to then take that and forward it on to Dr. Todd O'Hara at the UAF Toxicology, Wildlife Toxicology Lab. Mm-hmm. And he said, send them to me. So she froze them, sent them. He was able to
Send me the birds.
Send me the birds, uh-huh. Yeah. He extracted the worms from the breast meat of the grouse, and then he sent them on to Colorado State University Veterinary School, And they were able to have someone there who could identify them. It was just very specialized.
Uh-huh.
And as it turned out, they went ahead and published a paper on it in the Ecological Society of America, and Victoria was in that. And they said it was the first time that this species of nematode, of worm, had been seen north of British Columbia.
Wow.
So it's, you know, this is kind of, to us, it kind of brings up this issue that, you know, everything is moving now. I mean, the plants are moving and the wildlife is moving, the weather is changing. So we're seeing, you know, new landscapes emerging, and understanding what comes with those is important. And the first people that see these things are people like John or Victoria. And if they have a way to share it, and because we have the communication systems in place and GPS, and we have, you know, all this stuff packed into these
in very short order, you can start talking about it. You know, when you and I were talking yesterday to get ready for the show, I was thinking about, well, what trends are you seeing? And one of the things you mentioned was ticks.
Yeah.
And that is something, tell us about that. Is it something you're looking for, or you're already starting to get observations on ticks in animals?
Well, the real capacity for looking for the emergence of ticks in Alaska is with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And their wildlife program, their veterinarians have been looking at this closely because currently, you know, there's a really great article in the Alaska Dispatch about this recently, but currently the only ticks we have in Alaska are either on squirrels or rabbits. And they're Alaska ticks, and we're used to them. They don't carry any weird diseases or anything like that. But the caribou, the deer, the moose, the sheep, dogs don't really have, you know, we're fortunate not to have that problem in Alaska. But
you might say yet.
Yet. But now we do.
Oh, okay.
So now they are establishing themselves in dogs, and they're not just dogs going out of state and bringing them back. So this is a big economic issue, because then you have to start getting into, you know, buying things that will prevent ticks on dogs.
Mm-hmm.
But also raises real questions about the health of our large land mammals like moose, because the ticks have really done a number in Alberta all the way to Maine on the moose populations, and they carry diseases. And so what's happening now in Alaska is that the mule deer are starting to move from British Columbia and Yukon Territory, and they're coming into interior Alaska, and we're very concerned that they're going to bring winter tick with them, which brings disease as well. So so someone has to keep an eye out for that, and we're hoping that Leo will be part of that. Fish and Game, keep an eye on it. Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of things we could have talked about, but it was really great to hear from John in Unalakleet and also Rick in Fairbanks. So I'd like to thank you, Mike Brubaker, from the LEO Network. Thank you for coming over from ATNHC. And I'd like to thank Rick Toman from the National Weather Service in Fairbanks and John Henry from Unalakleet. And Charles Wolforth will be back as your host for Hometown Alaska next week. His topic is how the Anchorage Police Department provides information to the public. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Dave Waldron is our audio engineer. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.